we are a very amazing, in some way, a very amazing culture, and that it is important for us not to lose sight of that and not to sort of water it down and by any means. And I must say that my Habasha, let's call it, my Habasha culture, my Habasha roots, my language, the moral fixtures and boundaries of who I am have been amazingly supportive of what I have done, what I am, and I am deeply grateful for this culture, honestly. Mm. Very deeply grateful.
This is Salam and Hello, where stories of joy and justice vibrate with the rhythm of Africa and the diaspora.
Whoa, we that group of people trying to move along the line. Maybe one day we'll get
on. Salam and hello, everyone. My name is Lily Bakala Piper, and I'm so glad that you've joined us today. Today's episode is just a highlight for me. This year, we have had the great privilege to bring you many stories from accomplished writers, people in the creative economy, people who are innovating in climate and energy. We've just had a wealth of stories that we've brought to you. But today's story is probably my favorite. It's already my favorite, and it hasn't even begun yet, because the person that we have with us is not only a family friend and a beloved member of our Nairobi community and a beloved member of our Nairobi family, but truly a hero who inspires all of us. Nagzi Gebremedin is a very long-term Kenya resident with Ethiopian and Eritrean roots, and he's known for very many things. He spent several decades in the world of civil engineering and urban planning, both here in Kenya as a part of UNEP, the United Nations Environmental Program, as well as in Eritrea, his home, where he served the government and helped to make sure that cultural homes and heritage were preserved. He's an author of a book, which you'll get to see in a moment, called Asmara, that really gives a tribute to the beautiful architecture and design of that incredible city. In addition to that, in addition to being also a father of three and a grandfather of six, he is also an accomplished mountaineer. Just this last August, at the age of 90, he climbed Mount Kenya for the 14th time, making him the oldest person to ever grace the slopes of Point Lenana. What an incredible feat. In addition to climbing Mount Kenya 14 times, he's also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro 4 times at the ages of 25, 50, 75, and then again at age 80. Aba Hagwe, as we affectionately call him, our Ato Nagzi Gebremedin, is somebody who doesn't see impossibilities. He sees the potential in not only the mountain cliffs that he's climbing, but the people that he's engaged with and worked with over the many years across the region and across the world. As a part of our extended family, he has been a source of wisdom and joy, reminding us where we come from, how anything is possible, and how grateful he is to be alive today to share his experiences with all of us. And I think today, listeners, you are in for an incredible treat to learn from the wisdom, the experiences, and the life of Nagzi Gebremedin, our most honored guest today on Salam and Hello. So Aba Hagwe, Baba Naitsky, such an honor to have you with us today.
My pleasure. I'm deeply honored also to be with you, Lily.
We've had many of these conversations at holiday tables, on vacation together, but today to have you in studio is just a great delight. Thank you so much. Asante, sana, batam.
I feel deeply honored, honestly.
Such a joy. We have, in some ways, me and my family have kind of forced ourselves on you to adopt us into your family, but it's been one of the greatest blessings of our Nairobi years to share life with you. And over the years, I've gotten to hear some of the stories of your life and experience, from studying to traveling to work and career. So for our listeners, before we get into your mountaineering stories, let's give them a bit of background. You told me before the show a bit more detail about your background. So let me give the highlights and then I want you to fill in.
Okay.
You were born in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia to Eritrean parents, Aster and Ato Gabrameden. And you studied in Addis Ababa throughout your youth, going on to get your first degree from Haile Selassie University in engineering. And then halfway through your studies, Emperor Haile Selassie himself sent only 8 students to the United States to finish their education because there wasn't yet maybe the level of sophistication and the higher education outcomes. So you traveled to the University of Kansas.
Yes.
At the age of 19 in 1951. 53?
Yeah, 53.
Incredible. Yeah. So maybe let's start your story there as a young student in the United States.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about why you chose the field of engineering and what your impressions were as your educational journey took a turn to the West.
Yes. Well, I'm not 100% sure why I chose engineering. But there you are, I did. my younger brother, Ezra, who is a very distinguished theologian, a specialist in patristics, who was younger than me, but absolutely top-class performance academically, he actually came with me to the engineering college because he just got too scared about being separated from me, although that wasn't his line. But I was quite clear that I was going to be an engineer. And I started, as I say, in Addis Ababa and then went on to Kansas. As you quite rightly said, the emperor had selected 8 of us. I had no idea where Kansas is and what it was. And you must remember that we were basically barefoot boys. So the emperor's tailor had to design outfits for us that were suitable for the weather and the condition of America. And their perception is that a heavy woolen suit, 3-piece with a tie and a hat, a fedora, was what we should do. So we arrived in Kansas, myself and one other Ethiopian called Ato Talanubina. We arrived in Kansas, fully dressed in this outfit, in the heat of Kansas summer.
I was going to say, if it's summer,
terribly
hot. It's uncomfortable.
When the dean of students, a wonderful man called Dean Woodrow for the University of Kansas, he looked at us and said something like this. Out here in Kansas, you know, boys, we sort of get dressed for the weather. We felt that was permission to get rid of the clothes, took out our clothes, bought some what they call seersucker shirts.
Yes.
And we had a very wonderful time in Kansas. We met some wonderful people. It was a difficult time. After all, this was before the so-called Board of Education.
Yes, where, Brown v. Board, which was 1954, I believe. Yes.
And all, even schools were segregated.
Yes.
I remember I had to travel all the way to from Lawrence, Kansas to Kansas City, Missouri. A 1.5-hour bus ride to have my hair cut. Anyhow, we did very well in Kansas. We completed our education. And
I want to ask you a few questions about your years in Kansas.
Yes.
First, do you know how you were selected as 8 by the emperor? Was there an exam you took? Was there some kind of process?
Yes. We were, I think, the first group of students who were allowed into the nascent College of Engineering, and it wasn't developed fully. So after the first 2 years, they decided it's better until we develop the facilities, laboratories, testing facilities, and everything that would require the production of very qualified. They sent us to America. I think when we sort of got the clearing examination, the selection process, there must have been about 23 of us, but 8 were selected.
Selected. And I guess the design was always for you to come back and contribute to Ethiopia.
Yes.
Yeah.
And at those times, the idea of staying outside your country was totally unthinkable. I'll tell you a story. The day I learned that I had finally qualified and I will get my Bachelor of Science degree in Structural Engineering, there were at least 3 or 4 more months for formal graduation.
Okay.
But I couldn't wait.
Wow.
So I went as soon as I was told by Dean Woodruff that I have qualified, I went to what they call Strong Hall, gave them address, say, kindly send my diploma to P.O. Box 1240. And that same evening, I packed my bag, left Lawrence, Kansas, went to Washington, D.C., where the Ethiopian embassy was.
Okay.
And said, give me a ticket, let me go back home.
Wow. That's so powerful to me.
Unthinkable to think of. I did not formally attend graduation because I wanted to go home.
You're ready to go home.
Yes.
Yeah. What was the community like for you in Kansas those early years? Like you said, it was a tumultuous time in the United States.
Yes.
Integration had not happened on any level, federally,
yes,
locally.
Yes, yes.
In fact, Kansas famously was fighting the Supreme Court on integrating just a few years later.
Yes.
What was that experience like for you as an Ethiopian, Eritrean young man in the United States?
I have to say that God was taking care of me and Talon also in a very special way. In His mercy, He sort of pointed out a wonderful family called the Blairs from Abilene, Kansas, who totally sort of adopted me and took very good care of me. So the unfortunate events surrounds the discrimination and the rejection of colored people from over didn't affect me too much. And then, of course, perhaps this innate pride and arrogance of Ethiopians, you mean?
Was a bit of a shield also.
they think, who on earth could be better than us? And the idea that we as Ethiopians could be discriminated, it doesn't enter your thoughts. So I thought of said, I sort of dismissed it.
Yeah.
They don't know any better. So the Kansas experience on balance was wonderful, I have to say.
Yeah.
Despite lots of difficulties, I really enjoyed it. I really, really had a wonderful time. Mm. And I was able to achieve my goal to get my degree and come back to Ethiopia.
Incredible. So much so that you forego graduation to hurry back home. And and when you get back to Addis Ababa, you also find Ethiopia in, you join the faculty actually. So it's a few years before there's much change, but you start teaching and research back at, now is it called Addis Ababa University at this point?
At that time it was called Haile Selassie University.
Okay, it's still Haile Selassie University. Okay.
It's called Haile Selassie University. And the faculty that I joined was called the Building College. It was funded by the Swedish government, and that was immediately became a lecturer, and also I was doing research, and particularly on what they call traditional architecture or vernacular architecture. How do local people build their homes? What are the materials they use? What is it? So, and I had this amazing experience traveling throughout Ethiopia, sort of looking at traditional, or we used the very fancy name, vernacular architecture. And throughout this travel, I was able to identify, I don't know, about 10 or 12 different varieties with different materials, all ethnic based.
Yeah.
The Tigray chief's house, the Tigray house, the Amhara house, the Oromo house, the Gurage huts and so on. And actually we established samples of these houses at the building college. Formally, by the time I finished, there were about 12 of them.
Okay, 12 amazing.
Full model homes.
Amazing.
So we went there to look at them. And now, the last time I was there, which was in about 6 or 8 months ago, there's only one left.
Okay.
The Chigray chief's house. All the others are somehow disappeared.
A good challenge for us to pick up again, though, to restore those.
So
yes. Much to learn from that.
Yes.
For sure.
Yes.
But at some point, you decided to further your education. So the next turn in your story comes when you apply and are accepted at the Massachusetts Institution of Technology, MIT, one of the world's finest institutions, to do your master's degree.
Yes. Yes. After working at the building college for at least 9 or 10 years, I decided to get my postgraduate degree, and so I got a scholarship again, generously funded by the Swedish government. I went to MIT. I was accepted to study at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it was a very wonderful experience. As you say, it's a very distinguished, wonderful. I made also, in addition to getting my degree, I made lifelong friends. Mm-hmm. The members of my class, even to this day, they come and visit me, and I come and visit them. Spent a wonderful 3.5 years, I think, divided into two parts. The first part I was alone. Then in the middle of my course, I came back to Ethiopia, got married, and took my new bride with me back to Cambridge.
Okay.
And she also was studying, but in another college there.
Okay, okay. So I'm curious for you, having been to the United States in the early 50s, and now coming back, by the time you go back to MIT, this is now...
1970s.
1970s. So you're still...
Late 60s.
Late 60s. So again, you know, this is still an era for the United States marked by quite a lot of transition and fighting for civil rights and inclusion. What was your experience like, you know, these 15 so years later?
yes, a lot had changed. A lot had changed in America, and I must say that deep down there were cases where you could really be severely tested by the color of your skin. And so, I remember I was given an assignment at MIT to go to one of the suburbs, the Boston suburbs, to see and get a feel of how plots were taken care of, were they properly manicured, what kind of vegetation is there, how much was it, the cover, the floor area, and so on. And one of the tenants saw this black man, black boy, black person running around. So he called the police, and the police came and asked me, "What are you doing in this neighborhood?"
Yeah, a familiar experience for many people.
I had to quietly explain, I am a student, and But anyhow, I realized that this wasn't something common. So even at those times, they were trying possibilities.
At that time, did your feelings about staying in the U.S., had that changed? Or was your intention still that I'm here for a temporary assignment and then I'm...
Right.
Yeah.
The latter. I'm here for a purpose. The idea of residence in that had never came up at that time. It came much later in a way, but as soon as I did my degree there, together with my dear wife, we came back to Ethiopia. As soon as we finished, she had done her degree also, and then we came back to Ethiopia.
I'm curious, Abahagwe, you know, from those experiences, both your initial trip to Kansas when you were one of two students coming now, then later to Massachusetts, eventually as a part of a unit, what did you learn about yourself outside of just the academics that you were pursuing?
I'm a very stubborn person by nature. I guess the things I do because I am extremely stubborn, don't give up easily. And many of the seeming obstacles, I was always able to come. And I must say that the faith and solid dependence on the Almighty who transcends everything that my dear parents instilled in me and was, of course, the fundamental reason why I could survive. My faith that I am a child of God and that I have every right in this world as anyone else, but that I have a responsibility also to be kind, to be as responsible as possible. That sort of helped me. So character-wise, stubbornness. But the capital that was in me, the capital that invested was the idea that I am a child of God, God will always take care of me, and that my responsibility is to be as considerate and as loving as possible.
What did you learn about Ethiopia, our culture, maybe even the continent more broadly, in this time away, when you were disconnected from everything you knew that was familiar?
It sort of reinforced the idea this is quite a unique country, quite a unique culture. It's reinforced the idea that we are a very amazing, in some way, a very amazing culture, and that it is important for us not to lose sight of that and not to sort of water it down and by any means. And I must say that my Habesha, let's call it, my Habesha culture, my Habesha roots, my language, the moral fixtures and boundaries of who I am have been amazingly supportive of what I have done, what I am, and I am deeply grateful for this culture. Very deeply grateful.
Yeah. So you come back home after getting a degree from MIT, master's in city planning.
Yes.
I often wonder when I drive around Nairobi, was there a city planner here, by the way? So what a valuable tool to come back to the continent with, back to Addis Ababa.
Yes.
And tell me what happens next. You now begin to further your career, but there are some changes politically on the horizon.
That's right. I came back at a fairly difficult time when the government of Ethiopia began to change. His Imperial Majesty lost power. A communist or socialist regime began to take over. And the so-called Mengistu Haile Mariam's time made life very difficult for us. Mm-hmm. I had an older brother who was a major general in the police force, who was imprisoned by the Derg. And to make the long story short, after many years of imprisonment, he was executed. But before his execution, there was a time when it's a kind of a pro forma performance of trying to examine in a legal way some of the things he was supposed to have done wrong. And I was responsible for sort of helping him fight this, but it didn't work. And in any case, to make this long story, I was not able to survive at that time. They connected me with my my brother, the Major General, and what he stands for, I was having a lot of difficulties. So I made the decision, I'm not going to survive. It's going to be very difficult for me. I left my family, came to Nairobi, because I had contacts with the UN Environment Program people. I came to Nairobi, and fortunately, I got a consulting assignment. Mm. And I was fortunate enough to bring my family, my three children and my wife, and I got a job with the UN. And that was my, and then I had decided, now, I think this is a job that I should try and retain until I retire, because these other things, they have got difficulties with them. So I was with the United Nations Environment Program in Nairobi. And that's when my life in Nairobi began.
That's when love came for Nairobi.
Yes.
You also come to Nairobi at an interesting time. You know, they're only not even 10 years post-independence, or just right at that. So you find Kenya also at the time of your arrival. Maybe was it just the beginning of Moi at that time, or was Kenyatta in power
Kenyatta was still around.
Around. So you're still under the first president. Yes. You really have lived through some very critical moments, both in American history, but in the history of the continent, in Ethiopia, and then now in Kenya. Yeah. Tell me how you found Nairobi in those early 70s when you arrived.
Yes. I don't know whether I would take you back, but I had first visited Kenya before it was independent. In 1959,
okay,
it was still a Kenya colony, but that's quite another story.
No, I would love to hear it. What brought you to Kenya at that time?
Yes, my boss at the building college in Addis Ababa and his family, they're Swedish, is a very adventurous man. He had a Volkswagen Kombi, what they call the Volkswagen, and he had five children, and he wanted to have a holiday in Nairobi in Kenya.
Okay.
But he said, you come with us because you can help us drive. It was like, I'm a good driver.
Drive from Addis Ababa to Nairobi.
Yes.
Okay.
So that is, this family was going to have a holiday in Kenya. I have very, very little clue about Kenya. Not too much. I mean, I've read something about it, but I joined them as an extra driver.
Oh my goodness.
So we drove from Addis Ababa all the way to Nairobi, but it took us about 2 weeks to get to Nairobi. But it
took
about 11 days to come to the border.
Wow. I can only imagine both how beautiful that drive must have been, but exhausting also. Very, goodness.
It was quite something, I have to say. We arrived at the border post, what is it?
Zamoyale?
Yes.
Okay.
Border post. At that time in 1959, Kenya was going through the unrest, so there was curfew. Blacks were, you had to be home by before dark. Anyhow, wherever Moyale, they had no difficulty allowing the Swedes to cross, and they said, "But who on earth is this? What is it?"
Yeah.
They finally convinced them to allow me to come with them. But from then on, Kenya was quite a something. I had to sleep in the car when they went to the hotel.
Wow.
And we drove from Moyale through Marsabit and all the way to through Nanyuki to Nairobi.
Wow.
And I couldn't stay in a hotel because you're not allowed to. And they had come for a holiday, so they checked into one of those big hotels here in Nairobi.
Wow.
Then I was told,
make it go somewhere, not here.
No, so Kenya colony at that time was not an easy place for a black person. Anyhow, I found a small little hotel on Grogan Road, what they call Grogan Road, in the thing, and I stayed there. And my group that I was with, the Swedish family, they decided to go to Mombasa for that holiday.
Okay.
It would have been more hell for me.
Oh my
I wouldn't have stayed. So I said, you go. What are you going to do? I said, well, I'll try to find something. and I stayed behind. And that's when I decided to travel to what they call Tanganyika, which is now Tanzania.
Wow.
I said to myself, go to Tanganyika and see if I could do something there. I had this idea that maybe I can climb a mountain. I have no idea what that wasn't going to entail. I have not climbed any mountain. That's how.
And you just drove to Tanganyika, slash Tanzania. Okay, took the native bus
from Nairobi to Namanga. And from there, you cross the border and go to Tanganyika territory, which is still not independent
either, yes.
And I have a friend called a pastor called Ephraim Amos Limo. He lives in Marango, which is the so-called Chaga tribe around the mountain.
Okay.
I knew him from America. So okay. I said, I'll go to him and see whether he can sort of help me to do something there. So I come there. I come to Namanga and I say to Pastor Ephraim Amos Limo, you know, maybe I could climb the mountain.
Kilimanjaro.
Okay. Yeah, Kilimanjaro. But at that time, it was still called the tip, because okay. the tip was called Kaiser Wilhelm Spitz.
Is that right?
Yes.
After some, it sounds like a German or something.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, because you know the mountain, it's very interesting. The mountain was given as by Queen Victoria, gave the mountain as a gift
to her
cousin,
the
Kaiser Wilhelm, and the border was drawn. The border was drawn, and that's where from so-called Tanganyika or Tanzania, it became.
I see.
From Kenya, it became part of Tanganyika.
Wow! I see the border that the drawing being that between Kenya and Tanzania,
yes.
Included Kilimanjaro there.
That's right.
Yes, I see. Okay, so then you meet your friend, and he says to you, you should try to climb this thing.
No. I said I want to climb it.
Okay.
And he said, but you don't have any experience. What are you going to do? And I said, oh, let me see. I have a leather jacket, corduroy pants, and boots. They're called engineer's boots. So I have those boots. And I actually literally had a towel, and a baseball cap.
You said, I have what I need. That's enough. Two legs,
yes.
Two arms.
Yes. And,
wow.
But the good thing is that my dear friend, Pastor is Ephraim Amos Limo. He got me absolutely the top guide.
Okay.
Johanna was his name, one of the most famous guide. And he really took such good care of me. So we climbed up all the way to the top and back again. So I came down, actually, I wanted to do it also in record time, so I was really going very fast. But anyhow, I made it. That was my first.
And how long did that take, that first climb?
My first climb took 3 days, actually.
3 days to the top of Kilimanjaro. And I want everyone listening to just take that in, please. Age 25 with a towel on your head.
Yes.
3 days to the top and back down again.
And guess what happened? Because I wasn't ready and I didn't have the kind of things on, I lost all my skin. Despite the fact that I'm black-skinned, and this is black skin is supposed to, I lost all my skin.
From the sun exposure.
Face. Yes.
Wow.
It was terrible. It was, and for days, for 2 days I slept and the people who were taking care of me thought I was dead. So occasionally they used to come and say, are you there still?
Wow. So you did it in 3 days, but you would not advise that now.
No.
Because it took some, there's some recovery involved in this.
No.
But incredible. That stubbornness that you said was determined to just have this adventure. Incredible.
Yes.
So then you come back to Nairobi
I came back to Nairobi. I flew back to Nairobi because they were driving back.
Okay.
I flew back to Nairobi and I went back to my work. But I climbed the mountain again when I was 50 years old.
Amazing, amazing. How were you different that second time?
Well, I was better prepared. I had not a towel, but proper balaclava and so on. And I also climbed it for the third time when I was 75, and then when I was 80.
Amazing. Amazing.
So four times I've climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. And that is how, actually, my interest in mountain climbing, as soon as I did it the first time, I started to feel very strongly about it. Then starts the story about Mount Kenya.
Yeah, okay. So you have this adventure climbing the mountain at 25, and this Kilimanjaro adventure seems to really plant a seed in you.
Yes.
For adventure, for mountain climbing, for this love of pursuing sometimes what seems like the impossible. But before you get to, you know, this extensive mountain climbing career, you spend some time back in Eritrea and you come to author this beautiful book that I'm so grateful to have a copy of. Tell me about this now visit, because what I find fascinating about your story is not only that you have been in historic places at historic times, but there's always this pull towards home as well, that there's this constant pull back towards service and investing in your home country. So as you're wrapping your career at UNEP, Eritrea is now newly independent or newish independent, and you are invited, asked to help contribute to this newly independent nation, but of course an ancient culture and history. So tell us about that chapter of your life.
Yes. Yes, Eritrea became independent after some 30 years of struggle. And 1991, and I retired in 92, and I was invited by the new government to come and help, see if I could just assist with urban planning and so on. And I accepted. I went immediately after retirement. I went, and as a volunteer, we established a project called Cultural Asset Rehabilitation Program with funding from the World Bank. And one of the things we had in mind was that the Italians had built Asmara in the 1930s. When the so-called rationalist architecture or modernist architecture was at its highest. There are enclaves of modernism in several places, including New York, for example, Napier, New Zealand is another one. There are a couple in Latin America, in Argentina and so on. But in Africa, one of the largest concentration of the so-called modernist architecture, a big enough, critically large, is in Asmara. Why is that? Partly because the other people, the other countries, they had enough resources to change, destroy, build a new one. This one was stuck there. And we have always said, Asmara has preserved not because of real wish to do it, it's because of poverty. They couldn't destroy these things and build another. Then it became clear to the government that the largest concentration of modernist architecture was there. So I concentrated on that. We got resources from the World Bank. We had about a 12-kilometer square area where at least another 500-600 buildings that were to be preserved. One of them, the cover is of a bar. It is a very typical modernist architecture bar, which still works. The most classical one is that filling station called Fiat Taliero, which looks like an aeroplane taking off. But I had a wonderful time just examining, learning about this amazing architect, went to Italy several times to see if I could collect funds. Incidentally, I need to say this, it's quite unusual, but the Italian government and most Italians tend to be a little shy about the fascist time.
Mm.
They don't like it. Mm. They don't really
understandably
want to.
Understandably
so. Really?
Understandable.
Italy was the last place to get any assistance. Mm. They were very shy about it. Mm. And whenever you start talking about so-called fascist and Mussolini and so on, you start to say, oh my goodness. Anyhow, this book, which was written largely with the assistance of two colleagues, of mine, Edward Dennison and his wife Guang Yu, both wonderful young architects. It was the basis on which Asmara then became what they called a World Heritage Site. Has been registered as a Human Heritage Center by UNESCO now.
Mm.
I am a little concerned that not as much preservation is being done with this so-called historic architecture, but I had just a wonderful time studying this and so learning a lot about it. Mm. Yes. So, and that's one of the results is this book.
This book. Let's turn our attention to these mountains because I want to just dig into the story. You climbed the Kilimanjaro at age 25.
Yes.
When do you meet Mount Kenya?
Yes.
For the first time, I should
say. That's right, yes. It was in the early 80s when a man called Kenneth Matiba, who is a very well-known Kenyan politician who owned Naromoro River Lodge, invited me. I had met him. I don't know exactly how, but invited me to come and join a whole bunch of people to climb Mount Kenya. And he was a very wonderful man who knew about my exploits on Mount Kenya, Mount Kilimanjaro, and he had invited a whole lot of people to come to Mount Kenya, and he called me and said, Gabriel Medin, please remember this is a team effort. In other words, he was telling me, don't rush, don't show off. It's a team effort. Because they were all women, men, and so on. That was the first one. And then he led us into surgery. And it's close enough at home, close enough to Nairobi, that you can drive early on a Saturday. And so I started to go up there.
And
doing it. Shorter.
Oh, my goodness. So you were how old the first time for Mount Kenya?
Mount Kenya, I was 1983.
Okay, so you were 50?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, yes. This is a good challenge for me. I've done Mount Kenya once, but I've said I'd never do it again, but maybe I need to rethink before I hit 50.
Yes.
Your son, my dear friend and brother, Mogis, tells a story of him climbing with you once.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Fortunately, at that time, I understood it was going to rain, so I tried to rush them.
Hurry, let's beat the rain.
And unfortunately, it was, except me, I don't think anyone else.
Anyone else finished?
No.
And you did that one, and is it 2 days, I heard?
No, that one I not, but other times I have done it in 2 days. There were several times I used to start very early on a Saturday morning, but Sunday night I'm back.
Oh my goodness. So very early on a Saturday morning, it would be like 3 a.m., something like that?
Yeah, 4 a.m., 1 a.m., I start driving.
Goodness.
Go to Naromoro, park the car, at Met Station, climb up to Point Lenana, come down, drive down to Nairobi.
Oh my goodness, just a weekend adventure.
Yes, I've done it several times, I have to say.
Why? What's the allure for you and this mountain? Why?
I maybe I can use the phrase that my dear old father, very sedate Ethiopian, extremely calm, who thinks that achievement is done by something else, not physical nonsense. He said about me, he didn't say it to me, it was after I entered car racing rally.
Okay.
With a fairly new car, turned over, completely destroyed the car, although I was saved. So then my father used to say, I don't understand. There must be something bothering him.
That must be the why. That's the why he's climbing.
Why? I don't know. There must be something bothering me. But I like challenges. I really like challenges, especially physical challenges. You know, I used to be a boxer also in high school.
I did not know that.
Yes, I used to be a boxer. But unfortunately, not physically suited to boxing. One of the most important ingredients or advantages of a good boxer is that you have to have a long arm.
Okay. Yes, makes sense.
The reach is the most important. You're a small person.
Yeah.
A very poor man who has got long arms will just knock you down.
Right.
Anyhow, I became so stubborn about learning, being a champion boxer, that I outlasted everyone. I was a very famous boxer at the General Wingate School.
Amazing. So you start this climbing from Nairobi, weekends, different events. But now, like you said, the first one is 50 and you've done it 14 times since. It becomes a thing for you. And who are your companions as you travel? Do you have a favorite climbing friend or family member who has joined you and made these trips, you know?
Unfortunately, most of my closest, which are my children and some of my cousins and so on, have all given up on me. I did take my brother once, my younger brother Ezra. Radagzi would never come with me. So my brother Radagzi, but there have been one or two kind of crazy people like me who have been with me to the mountain. But it's also, I made some wonderful friends who are committed. For example, this guide called George, quite an amazing. He really takes care of
you. How many climbs have you done with him, do you think?
At least 7, 8.
Okay, wow.
At least.
Yeah.
George is also, he understands and he lets me, you know. Yeah. He will help me a little when I need it.
But, yeah.
I don't know, what has this done for me as a person? That it has given me kind of a confidence that I can always do it. I am 90 years old.
Yeah, you're 90. Happy birthday. This year was a special one.
I'm 90 years old.
Yes.
And I'm still physically quite okay. And I think it also influences your mental capacity also. My memory is not as bad as... one would have expected it. I feel deeply grateful to God that, you know, I mean, most people at this age are...
Yeah, they're not where you are.
So I would say constantly moving has been a deep ingredient of this success. Move. Keep moving.
Yes, every day you still do your daily walks, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, yes. Yeah. I never miss the 10,000 steps, even more. Never miss. I haven't done it in several months. Yeah. Maybe because I was traveling, I may have missed it.
Sure.
I have to say that
I must also, in addition to the muscles and so, the brain needs to work.
Yes.
You know, I am an addict at Sudoku.
Okay, fantastic.
I really never miss a Sudoku. In at least two of the papers, in The Nation and in the Standard, I do my Sudoku. And then I try to be as grateful as possible. Mm-hmm. Being a very grateful person, I think, has a great deal to do with being positive and so on.
Yes.
And you can see I try to laugh a lot.
Yes, I think you've hit on such a beautiful keys to life, you know? Move your body, move your mind. Laugh a lot.
Yes.
These are wonderful tools that are accessible to all of us. Yes. To all of us. Abba Hagoy, what did this 90th climb mean to you, and what did it teach you? I will speak from my perspective as somebody who is a part of your extended Nairobi family and who loves you. We were nervous a bit about this climb.
Yes.
But tell me, what did it mean to you, and how did you get, did it feel different than the previous 13 climbs that you had done?
Let's start with the difference.
Mm.
It was excruciatingly difficult, especially coming down. Going up was not so bad, but I have to say that going down was one of the most difficult, one of the most painful, one of the most trying. But there were times I have had. But there was nothing I can do, and I was there, and so on, and George sort of encouraged me, but I have to say that this last climb physically was extremely testing, I have to say. Mm. I didn't have much difficulty going up, but coming down was very difficult.
Yeah, that's something people don't know about mountain climbing. I think that the descent is
the
very
worst,
taxing.
The most difficult part. Mm. So if you have succeeded to go up, don't worry, so you'll come down somehow anyhow, but it's not going to be easy.
Yeah.
What else did it mean to me? That I could, in a way, demonstrate that even at this advanced age, that you are able to do this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not too excited about setting a record, or it's not to be registered anywhere. It was just that I was able to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That I was able to do it.
For the joy of doing it, yeah.
And be able to. I'm not entirely sure that there's going to be any more.
Mm.
I keep exercising, but it was an affirmation that you can do it.
Yeah.
And if it can be an example to those who are more or less sort of giving up when they are 70 or 80, if there is a possibility that this could be an example, you know, if this little 90-year-old man can do it.
It's possible for you. Yeah.
Why not me?
Why not?
Why not?
Yeah.
If he at 90 can do it, why couldn't I?
Yeah.
And what are his sickness? Oh, he says he keeps moving. He keeps moving. That's important. You keep moving. Don't ever give up. Don't ever give up. Movement is so, so, so important. And so I hope before I finally, the good Lord calls me, that there will be many, many more people who will climb mountains.
Yeah. I think after hearing this, I hope many people will heed that call. Abba Hagoy, thank you for your example. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for the blessing and the wisdom and the joy you bring to our lives.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Such a joy to have you with us. And listeners, we're going to link to some stories and articles where you can read more about Ato Nagsi Gebremedin's historic climb to Mount Kenya, his 14th climb at age 90. But we hope you also share this episode. Share, like, subscribe, send it to somebody who needs some year-end inspiration. Send it to somebody who is facing some mountains. And I hope that you'll be lifted by this story. And as our last episode of the year, I couldn't think of a better way to wrap up the year that has been challenging for many of us and unexpected turns and twists, much like the mountains present. And I hope today Baba Naizghi's words really mean something to you and resonate with you wherever you are, that nothing is impossible and the determination to continue is within all of us. So we wish you a blessed, blessed 2025, a happy new year, a happy holiday season with your loved ones. And we hope to meet you here on the other side in the new year. So from all of us at Salam and Hello, Rahma, our team at IR Studios, the guests that we've had on this year, thank you, thank you, thank you for being with us. And we wish you peace and joy and good health now and always. See you in 2025.